Hey, good afternoon. Thank you all very much for coming to Demystifying Team Foundation Server Build with me. So, hey, I'm Mickey Gousset. I am a principal consultant at InFront Consulting Group, and I am very, very happy to be here. So I'll put this slide up at the end, but it's got my contact information, so mickey.gousset@infrontconsulting.com. I'm an application lifecycle management MVP. I have been since 2005, so I love TFS and ALM. I even loved it more when it was called Team System, but it's, you know, it's really good product. I really, really like all the stuff that it can do. So you can find me on Twitter, though not that much, because I've been working on a super secret project, which is not so secret, which is updating the book. I run TeamSystemRocks.com, which is slowly morphing into ALMRocks.com because the Team System name doesn't exist anymore. And you can also find me on Radio TFS, which is a podcast that I host. So I love doing community stuff. I love answering questions. I love trying to find the answer to people's questions. So take my email address down, take my Twitter down, send me an email. If you've got questions, I'll try to get you an answer. If you want to find me today or tomorrow, I'll probably be down in the TLC, or I'll be glad to work with you to find out, to meet up with you while we're here this week. A couple of quick books, just so you know. I was lead author on Professional Application Lifecycle Management with Visual Studio 2010. And I tech edited the TFS 2010 book. Both these are available downstairs. Both these are going to have a lot of applicability, that's a big word, toward both 2010 product and the 2012 product. So something to keep in mind. So I've been doing a lot of talking and doing a lot of joking, and hopefully you've been kind of interested in the past 30 minutes. But our goal with this talk is to talk about Team Foundation Build. And it's it's a level 300 talk. So kind of stick with me. So we're going to go through the basics of, we're going to spend about, a couple of minutes talking about why we care about build automation. How many people in here are using some sort of build automation right now? Sweet. How many people aren't? How many people think hitting F5 on their computer is build automation? No. So we're going to talk about that for a second, talk about why build automation is important. It sounds like a lot of people in here are using it, so they understand. Some people aren't, so maybe you'll get a good idea of why it's important. And then we're going to look at how you do build automation with Team Build. All right? So we're going to go through some basics and start off with the basics of, all right, this is how it works. We're going to queue up some builds. We're going to look at some of the different ways we can make these builds run, because you have a lot of different options. We're going to look at the build results. Just kind of, get a good foundation of how it works. So you get an understanding of the basic build process. And for a lot of people, that's all they need. They just want the basic build process to do smoke tests or be able to do just actual daily builds or whatnot. Then we're going to move on from that and look at how we customize the build process. And we're going to learn about how the build process is made up of Windows workflow aspects, and we're going to be able to go in there and actually do several different customizations to it. And finally, we're going to wrap up by looking at how we can actually take those customizations, wrap them in a Windows workflow activity to make it where we can easily reuse those customizations on all the different on multiple different build activities by reusing the same code. So that's kind of where we're the progression and the path that I'm going to follow. So if you'll stick with me from beginning to the end, that's where we're going to end up. If we've got time at the end, I'll take questions. If we don't, I'm going to get out of the way for the next speaker that has to come, so give me 2 minutes to shut everything down, and I'll stand right over here and answer questions as long as anybody wants me to. So we got plenty of seats here, plenty of seats over there, so come make yourselves comfortable. So build automation. Why do we care about build automation? Why do I care about build automation? I hit F5, works on my machine, I check it in, I go home, right? No. The problem is there's no guarantee that just because it works on my machine that it's going to work when I integrate your code and everybody else's code. So that's what kind of build automation gives us. It gives us this ability to improve our software quality, because if we're running, say, a daily build, then every night that build's going to run, and we're going to come in the next morning and we're going to know where things stand, right? We're going to know whether the build passed, if it didn't pass. If it didn't pass, I'm going to know who broke the code. And then they have to bring in the cookies. So, but it helps us improve our software quality. And I like this phrase. Martin has used this phrase before. It's really kind of like the team heartbeat, all right? The problem with building large applications, especially when you've got multiple developers building on those applications, is that If you don't put it together till right before you're supposed to ship it, you're going to have a couple of fun nights. It's the idea with automation is, let's constantly build this thing. Whether we're doing it daily, we're doing it hourly, we're doing it every check-in. If we constantly build this thing, then we constantly know where things stand in the product so that we know what's working and what's not working. It really is, like I said, it's the heartbeat of your team so that you know where things stand with your code base. And builds also allow you to go back to your stakeholders, your managers, when they say, well, where's the product stand? And rather than just saying, well, we're 57% complete right now, you're able to say, well, we did a build last night, and the build completed, and that build has these chain sets in it, so it has this functionality in it, so we're feeling pretty good that this functionality is working. Plus, we can then go in TFS and look at the tests and see what tests have been run and be able to say, and these test verification tests have been run against it, so we're feeling pretty confident that A, B, and C are working in the product now. And Team Build is going to give you the option to do all that. It's not F5. So building on your machine doesn't count. And the reason is, if I just build it all on my machine, it doesn't necessarily mean I've got the latest changes. How do I get around that? I could do a get latest, right? Grab the latest stuff, bring it down local. That's what you should probably do anyway. But even that doesn't necessarily verify that everything is correct, because you're not running maybe the full suite of build verification tests or BVTs, or you're not running the full suite of other automated tests to help verify the application is working the way it's supposed to. And doing it local also doesn't help you from a standpoint of if you're going to do deployment, like deploying things off onto other machines, or if you're using lab management to be able to deploy from that standpoint. Doing it local doesn't help you. An automated build, most teams, once they move to using an automated build process, even if it's just a daily, nightly build process, they find that their productivity increases, they find that they've got a better understanding of where things are, and honestly, if you start making your developers wear the dunce cap anytime they break the build, they won't break the build near as much. So how Team Foundation Server helps us through all this, and Team Build specifically, is by providing that automated build process that actually integrates with the rest of Team Foundation Server. So bear with me, I've only got like four or five more slides in this entire deck, and then it's going to be demo the rest of the way. So it's considered now part of the core platform of 2012. It is a vital service that many, many people want to use. It's integrated with a lot of the other stuff in TFS, so it integrates in with Team Foundation Server version control. So it can pull information from the version control system. It can apply labels as it needs to. It's integrated with work item tracking because it can pull back work item information. It can create work items when the build fails. It can do all those different things. And it can also run tests. So you're able to run build verification tests or other automation tests to be able to verify that the build is performing the way you think it should. All this information gets captured in the TFS data warehouse. So you've got historical trending. You've got analytics. You've got any kind of reports you want to try to pull. One of the other key features, I think, in a build system is notifying team members of where the build stands. So I want to know if I kick off a build whether it passed or not. And personally, I want to know without me having to go back to the build window. Most everybody wants some kind of notification, email or something. And you can get that using the eventing model in TFS. You can actually sign up for emails to be sent to you based off of a build kicking off or a build finishing or a certain build not finishing, whatever criteria you want to look at. Now, in 2005 and in 2008, MS Build did everything, from both the compiling to all the orchestrating as well to what you wanted your build to do. Excuse me. In 2010, they changed that to use Windows Workflow. And before we got started today, we were having a slight discussion on whether that's better or worse. But Windows Workflow does do all the orchestration now. So it has the ability to do all that, figuring out what I want to do. And MS Build still does the actual compilation part. It still does the heavy lifting from that aspect. And we're going to look at some of the Windows Workflow stuff and how we customize that to customize our build process a little bit later in this talk. So this is I spent a lot of time on this next slide, a lot of time trying to come up with a great architecture slide for you. So you have the application tier. So when you queue up a build and kick off a build, it calls the build controller, right? So the build controller, the build service, is what takes care of monitoring the whole build process, okay? Now, in Team Foundation Server 2012, you have this thing called Team Project Collections. And a Team Project Collection is a collection of team projects. So basically, it's a scoping mechanism for your team projects. When you create a build controller, the build controller is scoped to the team project collection level. So I can have one build controller per team project collection. And all the team projects underneath that collection use that build controller. Now, so I have one build controller per team project collection. Now the build controller is going to actually call a build agent to do all the real work. So the build controller is the manager, the build agent is us. And a controller can call one, can have one agent that it has control of. It can have multiple agents. Those agents can exist on the same machine if you had some really super beefy hardware, or you can have those agents on multiple machines. So there's several different ways we can configure how all this stuff goes together. The controller is going to determine what agent to use based off of, you can have criteria in the build definition that tells the controller, hey, use this specific agent called tags. Or maybe the controller just says, well, I'm just going to grab the next available agent, and that's the agent I'm going to use. So it's going to call the agent, and the agent is going to actually perform the build, push all the stuff off to the drop server. If you're doing symbol servers or saving the symbols onto a symbol server, it's going to push all the symbols onto a symbol server. So that's the basic architecture. Could I have made this architecture better? Yes, I could have put multiple build agents in there because you could have multiple build agents. If you've got multiple team project collections, then you could have a build controller for every team project collection. But this is the basics of how it works, and that's kind of what I wanted to show to you. So, enough slides for now. Let's actually go look at the product. So I am running Brian Keller's virtual machine that he just released this week that has the RC on it, that has everything installed on it. So this is a virtual machine you can go download, go search for Brian Keller on your favorite search engine. You'll be able to find him. First link's going to be his blog where you can download this from. So I'm running the RC. So the first thing I've got to do when I'm going to do build stuff is actually, you know, install the build service. And that's already installed for me. But if I wanted to do some configuration to the build service, I can do that by opening the Team Foundation Server Administration Client. So if you go into Visual Studio Team Foundation Server, there's a Team Foundation Server Admin Client. Admin Client is where I can control build information. So I've got a build configuration section. So you can see here, I've got the build service running with a controller and an agent. Some of the properties from a build service perspective, just so you know, I'm specifying what collection this build service is for, because remember, I'd have to tie this back to a specific collection, and who the service needs to run as, which Brian cheated and used administrator. Administrator is probably not who you want your build service to run as, but it's just something to keep in mind. Once you've got your build service running, then I can come in here and specify my actual controller. So my controller, I'm basically going to give it a name. This version control path to custom assemblies we will fall back to at the very end of the talk. I can specify the number of concurrent builds it can run. And then here it's defined as the number of agents, or I could also specify the maximum number. And then for each agent that I have installed, I can control things such as the controller that agent reports to and the working directory. So here's the thing, right? The agent's got to get that code, pull it down from Team Foundation Server, and build it somewhere. So this is defining where he's going to build that code. So he's going to build it on whatever system drive of the computer that it's installed on in a folder called builds. And then it's going to create a folder that's the build agent ID. And then it's going to create a folder that's the name of the definition of the build that we're running. And actually, if you look in here, I've got a builds folder. It's currently empty. Keep that in mind. And my agent is running. So I've got everything running right now that I care about. So here's a tip, though, that some people don't realize. There's actually an event log related to Team Foundation build now. So you can click this link, and it'll actually open up an event log that will give you event information around Team Foundation build. So if your builds aren't running quite like you think, or at least the service is not starting for some reason, which has happened to me before, I couldn't get the service to start, this is where you can go to troubleshoot that. So that's a quick little tip for you as far as if you're wanting to troubleshoot your builds. So with the fact that we have everything running, let's go into Visual Studio. So in my classic tech ed form, I've created a very complicated application to show you on how to do build today. So if we go look at my complicated application, it's a console application that says hello world. Because the application I'm trying to build doesn't matter. The point is I'm trying to show you how built team build works. So I've got my application that I have checked into version control. So if I go in here, I've created a team project called TechEd Orlando, and then here's my project called Hello TechEd. So the first thing I want to do is, all right, let's build this thing, right? Let's just create a build, see how this build process works. So if I go to Team Explorer, ooh, look. Oh, I just undocked that, lovely. So if I go to Team Explorer got a facelift in Visual Studio 2012. How many people have seen this before? Okay, good, Ben, good. So it got a facelift, right? It's got this whole concept of pages now, and you go to a different page in Team Explorer. The idea is, let's keep you in that one window. I kind of like it. So up here, I can select the team project I want to connect to. In this case, I'm connected to TechEd Orlando, and I can select what page I want to go to. So I want to go to the builds page. So I've pre-built some build definitions here that we'll use in a little bit. But this is where you're going to start your whole build journey, okay? You can see all the build definitions that have already been created for you. I can favorite some of those so that I can rerun them easily. I can also see any builds that are currently running. I don't have any builds running right now, so, or the results of builds that have executed recently, which I don't have. Or I can create a new build definition. I also have some other actions I can perform, one of which is manage build controllers. So I can actually, all that stuff I was doing in the admin console, I can actually do from here as well. So I can manage my controller and my agent information from within Team Explorer as well. So let's actually build a new build definition. So it's the same kind of interface that we had before in 2010. You've got a bunch of tabs on the left-hand side. So we're going to call this Hello TechEd Manual Build, because I like my things to be descriptive. We've got three different options here for doing the actual, making the, for processing. Enabled means it's just going to work. Paused means I can queue up builds using this, but it's not going to actually execute the build till an administrator makes it happen. And then disabled means it's not going to be used. So if you've got build definitions that you've created that you're no longer going to use, but you don't want to get rid of them, you just mark them as disabled and move on. So I'm going to leave this enabled, of course. The next step is the trigger. Now, the trigger is where things get cool. So this is what makes the build kick off, right? You got manual. That's what we're doing now. Manual means I'm just going to go in there, and I'm going to queue this sucker up, and it's going to run. But you also have continuous integration. So how many people in here practice continuous integration right now? Sweet, sweet. So continuous integration is a process people use where every time you check somebody does a check-in, it kicks off a build. So every time you check in, it kicks off a build, which means that you know pretty quickly, if you've got a fast build, whether somebody's broken it or not, and then they get the dunce cap. So the drawback, though, around continuous integration is that if you have a huge team with a lot of people checking things in, you have a lot of builds getting queued up and kicked off. So that's where they added the option here of being able to do rolling builds, which basically means that if we're doing continuous integration, somebody checks in, it kicks off the build, five other people check in at that point in time, it's going to queue up those check-ins until that first build finishes, and then it's going to keep going. So if you find you're using continuous integration, but the builds are just taking forever and they're just queuing and queuing and queuing, rolling builds might be a direction that you want to go from that aspect. We also have gated check-in, and a new thing in 2012 called batched gated check-in. We're going to circle back around to that. I'm going to skip that for right now. And then you have the ability to run a build, you know, on a daily or a weekly basis or an hourly basis, whatever you want to do. So this is how you would select the schedule to configure your builds to run on, say, a nightly option. So my trigger is going to be manual. Now I've got to define my workspace. The workspace is the stuff I want to pull down that I need to be able to compile this application and where I'm going to put it. So I don't need Fabricam Fiber. And I don't need everything in my TechEd Orlando project, right? So I'm going to come in here and actually drill down to only pull my Hello Tech Ed solution down. And it's going to store it in this source directory and then in a workspace called WS2, which is fine. So if I have a project with a lot of stuff in it, you might want to go in and cloak, because you have the ability to do cloaking here, cloak different things or remove different things. So because you only want to pull down the stuff that the agent needs to build with. Because think about it, depending on how you define your definition, that could be a lot of stuff it's pulling down every time. So you only want to pull down what it needs to do the build with. This is kind of a key point that a lot of people miss, and they wonder why their builds are so slow, and it's because it's taking 10 minutes to pull all the files down. So, stick with me. So, workspace defines where our stuff's going to go. The ALM controller, this is the controller we're going to use. And then I have to specify, okay, where do I want to put my output files? So this is usually just a share. So I've created a share on here called, appropriately, TechEdDrops, where it's going to actually put my output files so that we can then do whatever, copy them off to a test server or do, you know, whatever our next step in our process is. But I also have this option here of this build does not copy files to a drop folder. Why would I ever want to do that? That's because you may have times when you want to run a build just to see if everything compiles. You don't care about the output. You're not going to do anything with the output. You're not going to test the output. But you want to run the build just to see if everything compiles. So in that case, you can configure a build definition here, but just say the build doesn't copy output files to a drop folder. And you don't worry about the output because you don't care. You still get the build results where you know what's going on. The process tab is where all the magic happens. The process tab is where you select your build template. So in this case, we're going to go with a default template. And you have to specify different items. First thing you got to specify is what you're going to build. And what I'm going to build is preset for me right now because I already had that solution open. And it assumed, well, you had the solution open. I assume you want to build that solution. But I can change that. I can come in here and select a different solution to build. It's going to build right now using the default platform and configuration of that solution. But I also have the capability to come in here and select other build options. And then you have the ability, using the default template, to set a bunch of different things. You can have automated tests run. So by default, it's going to look for any managed code, any DLLs that have the word test in them, in what you're trying to do. And if it's got the word test in them, it's going to assume there's tests in there that you want to run. It's going to try to run those tests. You can control the build number. So you can, by default, it's the definition name, it's the date, and then it's got a revision number, which is basically the number of times that build has been run that day so far. So if you queue up a build for the fifth time that day, it's going to put a 5 on the end. Again, these are all things you can change. So if you've got your own way of numbering things, you can number them however you want to. You can choose whether it cleans the workspace. You can mess with log verbosity. You don't really want to do that unless you're trying to troubleshoot your builds, because as you start turning up the verbosity from normal to detailed to diagnostic, your build logs get larger and the builds take longer because it's collecting more information. I can perform code analysis. If you went to Brian Randall's standing room only IntelliTrace talk, he talked about the fact that you could do symbol and source server and how those work from an IntelliTrace perspective and why you care. So that kind of stuff is built into the build process. So I can, by default, it's going to automatically index things. And then I can publish my symbols off to what's called a symbol server. A symbol server is also a file share, where basically you want your symbols to be kept so that if I need to debug this application 6 months from now, I can find the symbols to make that really easy to do. So I can just come in here and say, yes, I want this stuff to go to my TechEd symbols share. And then there's some advanced options on here as well, where you can really drill down into, do you want to create a work item when it fails? Don't want labeling to happen? And all that. So you can really, you know, customize your build definition from here if you want to, of the default build process. Final thing you've got to consider, and this is kind of important, is retention policy. How long are you going to keep stuff? All right? Meaning that if we're constantly doing continuous integration and every check-in is creating a build, we got a lot of files potentially building up on whatever server that we're using. So how long are we going to keep those files out there? So this shows you that for each type of build, failed, partially succeeded, or succeeded, I want to keep like the last 10. And if I delete a particular build, what I want to delete? Do I want to delete everything? Do I want to delete just part of it? Part of that goes back to if you've got regulatory compliance things where you've got to keep certain things. So this is kind of somewhere you need to do a little thinking about where you want to keep things as well. So let's save that sucker. And now I want to queue it up. Queuing it up is easy. Hey, look, there's my build. I'm going to right-click on it, and I can say, queue that new build. Now, the queuing window allows me to do some last-minute changes. Some last-minute, I may not want to follow this template exactly the way it works. I can change the build definition that I'm using. I can say, do I want to get the latest sources? Or do I want to get the latest sources with shelf set? So getting the latest sources means I'm going to get the latest sources. I'm going to build a regular old build. Getting the latest sources with shelf set means I've checked in. I've pushed a shelf set up to TFS. I want to do what's called a private build or a buddy build. I want to make sure this is going to work, that my stuff's going to work before I check it in. So basically, I'm doing my own version of a gated check-in. So I can specify my shelf set. It will run the build, run all the tests, do all of its magic. And then if it works, I can have it automatically check it in for me. So this is a way that I can make sure that I don't break the build. I can select what controller I want to use, the priority. I can change the drops. And then I have parameters. Now, check out this page because it's going to change in a little bit. But I have parameters that I can where I can reset some of those parameters around my build process. And when I'm ready, bam, I queue that sucker up. I can go to Manage Queue to see the builds that are currently running, and there's different icons here that will show me the status of the build. In this case right now, this one is running. Oh, and it failed. What did I do wrong? Unable to create workspace, VSS 12. Awesome. So, did something wrong there, but you can see the build will tell you what you did wrong. So that's good. No worries. We'll move on from that. We'll just go with Mickey's pre-built build. Let's queue that one up. You can come back in here. As you can see, I've got a queue and a completed tab. So my build is running. I can actually open this up and double-click it. And you've got some cool stuff on this page, right? It's showing me, in this case, the build is completed, so I'm on the build summary view. I can actually see that this build ran faster than the previous build. Kind of cool, little histogram that kind of keeps track of where things are. And I can see a summary of the build. No tests were impacted. Everything looks good. If I want to see the details, I can click View Log. Now, what I don't like is it looks like View Log and Open Drop Folder are related, but they're not. It's its own separate little link here. But I can view details of the log. In this case, it's very basic, but it shows me the details of what's happened in the log. I can actually open the drop folder. So this will actually take me out to the drop folder where I can see the files that were built. I can view log information by going to diagnostics and saying show me the logs, and it shows me the logs where I can drill down to what happened with that build. I can also assign build quality. Now, this is important, right? Especially if you're doing a lot of builds, if you're doing a lot of continuous integration builds or whatnot, you're getting a lot of builds built up in your system. Build quality is what's going to tell people what you're supposed to do with the build, right? Is it a good build? Did it have initial test pass? Is it ready for deployment? The heck with this one, it's really bad. We'll reject it. You know, and you can control the build quality. You can come in and actually add your own build quality statements. You don't have to use the ones that are out of the box. But you can use the ones that are out of the box if you want to. Yeah, manually. I come in here and go, ooh, look, initial test pass. So you've got to do it from a manual perspective. And then I have a bunch of different actions. Now, this is cool. I'm going to go to open in browser. I have access to almost all that same information through Team Web Access now. So I have the ability to queue up builds, I have the ability to open drop folders, I have the ability to view build information, view build files, all that through Team System Web Access, which means that now I can do most of my build queuing and viewing without having to actually go into Team Explorer if I don't want to. So I thought that was a cool, neat little feature that they added. Now, let me show you a gotcha. I'm going to come back in here, and we'll go to my pre-built manual build, and I'm going to edit that build definition. But you know what? I like my build names to be descriptive, right? Because we're told as programmers, use descriptive variable names. Use, you know, things that make sense. So this is a really long descript. I can't spell name for a build. I'm going to save that. So if I come back in here and I queue up this build, then we are going to come over here to Build Explorer. You'll notice that it failed. And it failed because the maximum length for a build number is 64 characters. So keep in mind when you're building out your build, when you're creating your build names, that you want to keep them short and descriptive versus long and descriptive. So let's change that definition back so I can reuse it again for something else. And let's talk about gated check-ins. So before I talk about gated check-ins, there's also, remember I talked about the fact that you want to get notified. You want to know where the current status of the build. So there's a cool little tool that you get under Team Foundation Server Tools called Build Notifications, which actually creates this little icon over here, or running in the action bar, that's a little pop-up toast. It'll tell you the current status of a build. It'll tell you when a build is completed or has failed, give you information about that build. So that's always a good thing to have. And you can come in here with the options and actually control what information or what builds you care about, as well as when it should show notifications. So I'm going to come back in here and change this trigger of this to go from manual build to be a gated check-in. So gated check-in means that when I check my code in, it's not actually it's checking it in. It's putting it on a shelf, and it's going to run a build using that shelf set. And if that build passes, it'll check the code in for me automatically. If the build doesn't pass, too bad. It'll let me know, and then I have to fix the problem. But that means that only code that passes the build makes it into version control, which sounds great because then I don't have to rebuild stuff. I mean, they don't have to fix anything. I can be assured, or close to being assured, that what's in my version control is, you know, pretty accurate. So I'm going to select gated check-in. I'll leave everything else the same, and I'm going to save that. Notice that the icon changed over here. It's now a little lock. That indicates this is a gated check-in build definition. So if I right-click on that, I can't really queue it up. Well, I could queue it up and kick it off manually, but I don't want to. I want to do this as a check-in. So let's not save those changes. So I'm going to come back over to my code, and in classic presenter style, I'll add a comment. And I'm going to save my changes. So I need to check these in, right? Well, the pending check-in window is no longer down here. It's actually part of Team Explorer now. So if I go to pending changes, here's my pending check-in window. So I can enter a comment, so this is a change. I can actually associate this with a work item, so we'll associate it with work item 77. And I will check in my code. Ooh, no, I won't, because I've got gated check-in running, right? So this is where it's going to tell me, you've got gated check-in running, I'll create a shelf set and run this and let you know what happens. I have the ability to preserve my pending changes locally if I want to, or I can bypass validation, but I got to have permission to do that. So I'm going to build this. So now if I go back to Build Explorer, notice over here that I have my pending changes when running. It's got a different icon next to it, which means it was running because of a shelf set. And I can open this up. You can see the different times that I've run it. And we'll think happy thoughts, and things should work like they expect them to. And it did. So, and it automatically checked it in for me. Had I made a change where it didn't work, the build would have failed, and it would have actually, my little toast would have popped up saying, hey, what you just tried to do didn't work. Do you want to uncheck, do you want to unshelve your shelf set so that you can fix it? So gated check-ins are great. The problem with gated check-ins is they only run one at a time. Okay? So kind of like with continuous integration, they can build up. So you have this option in 2012 that you didn't have in 2010 to be able to batch your gated check-ins. And this is kind of important. So if we go back in here and edit the build definition, and we go to the trigger, then I have the capability here to say merge and build. So what this will do is this will say if a build's already running, then what I'm going to do is wait for the next two check-ins. And then I'm going to merge all that code together and try to do the build. So basically, it's a batched gated check-in. So that way, your check-ins get done hopefully faster. Here's the catch. I check in a piece of code, and Brian checks in a piece of code. And they both get merged into this batched gated check-in. My code works. Brian's doesn't. And so the build will break. It won't. It'll break. So at that point, what happens is team build reruns the build twice, two more times, once with just my code in it, and then once with just Brian's code in it. My code makes it, so it gets checked in for me automatically. Brian's code doesn't, so it gets rejected, and Brian gets told he needs to go fix his code. This is new in 2012. So the point is, gated check-ins can make things run faster because I'm taking these three check-ins and building them at once. But if it fails, that means that it's actually going to run three more times, one for each check-in, so you actually ended up with an extra time of the build running. So it's something to consider if you're going to use the gated check-in process. But gated check-ins do work, and they are kind of nice. Okay, so remember I said you could run a build and actually not have it do any drops, right? So you can run a build and not actually have it drop any files. Why would you want to do that? One of the reasons people do that is because, and this was actually a question somebody asked in the TLC, they want a quick and dirty way to see all the change sets that have been checked in for that week. So what's a quick and dirty way to see all the change sets that have been checked in for that week? That stuff's in the reporting server, so technically you could probably go write a report to do it, but I want a really nice, fast, quick way to do it. Well, you can do that with Team Build. What you can do is this. Hey, look, there's my toast. Gated check-in committed. Woohoo! So, what we can do is this. We're going to change this back to being a manual build. I'm going to save it. On Monday morning, you run this build. All right? So this is just going to be my weekly build. Now, I don't want it to drop anything. I just run the build. So on Monday morning, I'll run this. So I can queue this sucker up and go queue. And go away. And there it is. And it's running. And it should complete successfully. And everybody is happy. Now, during the week, we're going to check some code in. So here's my second change. And I'm going to go over to my pending changes window. And I'm going to enter in a very valid comment. And associate with a work item just because I can, and check it in. Oh, build succeeded. And then we're going to come back down here and actually make a third change and do the same thing. Check that code in. Save our changes. So at the end of the week, I've got this build that I ran on Monday. I haven't run it since. At the end of the week, I come back over to my builds area and queue up that build one more time. You can see, again, I have my pretty little histogram. We'll give that a second to run, and it completed. And you can see, if I go down to associated change sets, it shows me all the different change sets that build picked up, because I ran the build on Monday, I ran it on Friday, so it picked up all the change sets that happened from that Monday to that Friday, which then allows me to at least pretty easily say, oh, I've got all these different change sets in there, so I need to make sure that the code related to those change sets gets tested next week when we put this onto the test server. Can you hold that, and I'll get questions at the end? Sorry, I don't mean to be rude. So hold that question. Write it down. So this is just a quick way you can see all the stuff that's happened in that particular week. Now remember, I also said you want to be able to see, like, do alerts and get emails and stuff. So TFS has an eventing model, a notification eventing model built into it. So I can actually come up here to Team and go to Project Alerts, and it takes me out to Team Web Access, where I can configure email alerts. Now I could do this before. I could do this in TFS 2005, 2008, and 2010. But I have a couple of extra features now. I mean, I have the capability to come in here and send me an email anytime a build completes, or my build, or somebody changes the build quality. But I've also got this advanced alerts management page now, where I can actually come in here and build a detailed queries on the types of alerts I want to get. So this allows me as a team member to determine the kind of stuff I care about and get the information, you know, emailed to me so I'm kept up to date. TFS is all about it's all about communication in my mind. It's all about making sure all the team members know what's going on at all times in the product. And this is one of the ways you can do that, especially around the build process. Hey, look, my build succeeded again. Yay. So, that's the basics of how build works. You come in here, you build, create your definition, you determine what code needs to be pulled down. Oh, yeah. Over here on the disk, I've got my builds folder, right? This is where the agent's going to build things. So in the builds folder, we have the agent ID. I've only got one agent, so its ID is one. Then I've got the team project, the actual build definition, and then the source code that it pulled down, as well as the binaries that it built for me. So all of that is put there because that's where the agent said it's going to put its stuff to build. Now, from an outputs perspective, I was putting everything in the drops folder. So in the drops folder, I've got my team definition, and then you can see I've got each of my team builds numbered 1, you know, 3, 4, 5, and 6 for the past 4 builds that I've done. And I can go into those and see the output. So in this case, I've got my executable. And if I go back over to TechEd symbols, then I have all the symbols related to each of those builds with the really ugly ID number. So it's working, right? No smoke and mirrors. Those directories were empty earlier. That's the basics, okay? And that's the basics. And for a lot of people, the basics get them started. If you're not using any kind of automated build process, start a nightly build so that you can see what's going on with your build process and then move forward. You don't have to use continuous integration if you don't want to. You don't have to use gated check-in if you don't want to. So, but this gets you started with the build process. Okay, so that's, you know, you're just going, Mickey, that's level 200 stuff, blah, blah, blah. It's a level 300 course. Get on with it. So, let's move on to the next step, okay? Next step. We've got the build going. We've learned a couple of tips. Next step's going to be, how do we start customizing our build process? All right? How do we start doing, making it work the way we want it to work? And that's where you have to get into customizing the build process template. So, I kind of hate that terminology because if you use TFS a lot, you hear people talk about process template all the time. Usually when they say process template, they're talking about a team project process template, the template you use to create your team project. So it creates your version control, creates your initial work item tracking, that kind of thing. With build, build also has a build process template. And the build process template just controls the build process. It's a Windows Workflow 4.0 XAML file. Most times when you create a team project, you get 3 of these out of the box. You get the default template. The default template is what we've been using and what most people use. You also have an upgrade template. So if you've upgraded, if you're upgrading from like TFS 2008 to 2010 or 2008 to 2012, and you've done build customization, when you run the upgrade on your server, it actually wraps your customized build templates in this update template. And for the most part, it should work, but you may still have to go in there and do some tweaking. And then if you're using lab management, there's a lab default template for working with lab management. Now, these templates are all stored in TFS. When you create a new team project, you'll see there's a build definition folder where you can that has all these templates in it, where then you can go into these templates and make changes. So that's what you're doing. By customizing these files, you're going to be able to customize your build process. So I credit Martin Woodward with this picture. I know it's really, really kind of small, but basically this is what the default build template does at a high level. All right, it gets the build definition, updates the build number, determines what agent it's going to use, then it gets the build directory, initializes the workspace, pulls the source down, does the compile, runs tests, associates with work items, indexes, publishes, copies to an output directory. So it does all those things. Knowing this general layout will help you when you start navigating into the build process template to be able to find exactly where you want to add in the customizations that you want to make. So let's do that. Here's the basic customization that I want to do. I want to take my output, my stuff that gets output from my build process, and I want to zip it up. Now, initially, I just want to zip it up. But at some point in time, I want to customize my build process to where whoever's defining the build can actually say, this is the type of zip file I want, whether a zip or a RAR, whatever type you want, as well as what the output file name should be. So I want to make it where that's customizable by the person that's doing the actual build definition. And then finally, I want to take that and turn it into a workflow activity that I can just use on multiple templates by just dragging and dropping onto there to where it then automatically gives me that functionality. So let's go back and see what kind of trouble we can get into. Okay, so the first thing we have to do is go back into Visual Studio. And you'll notice that, we'll look at the Fabrikam Fiber Team project for a second. There's a build process templates folder in there. That was created automatically when the project was created. And in that build process template folder, I have three XAML files, which are the default build, or which are the build templates. So the default template, the lab default, and the upgrade template. If we go back over to my Tech Ed Orlando team project, I've got those three default in there, as well as some other ones, because I've pre-built some of this to make it go a little faster so you didn't spend 3 hours watching me, you know, drag and drop things. But the first thing you've got to do is, how do I create a new build process template for me to be able to customize? And that's actually pretty easy to do, because I can come in here and right-click on this, I can go into a build definition, and I can say edit that build definition. And in the process area, I kind of glossed over this top part because it was just basically, I'm using the default template. But if you do a show details, this is where I can specify what template I want to use for this process, and where I can also create a new one. So by selecting the default template and then clicking create new, I have the ability to say copy an existing XAML file. Great, I'm going to copy the default template. I want to copy that back into the build process templates, and I want to give it a name. So we'll call this the Tech Ed Custom Build Process Template. And I'll click OK. Now, I'm not going to save my change to my definition, but if I come back over to my build process templates and do a refresh, then I now have that Tech Ed Custom Build Process Template in there. You can't tell it, but it's kind of grayed out, meaning that it's on the server, but I don't have it local, so I'd have to do a git latest on it to pull down the local copy so I can make a change. But this is where I now have a copy of the default template, because I didn't want to mess with the default template, because you know I had custom stuff to the default template. I get lots of people yelling at me because I break their builds. But I want to take this and start adding in my code to do the zip. Now, the way I'm going to do the zip is I'm going to use 7-zip. So, you know, Creative Commons, it's a, you know, open source out there that you can use. So what I did is I downloaded it, okay? I downloaded this the zip executable I want to use, and then in my team project, at the root of my team project, I created a tools folder. So my tools folder is going to contain all my different tools that I might use for different things. It could be for that I'm using in the build process, it could be using for other things. But I want to have the zip executable checked into my version control so that the agent can just pull it down and use it. I don't have to hard code necessarily onto the agent or go install on the agent the zip file, the zip executable. It's going to actually pull that down for me and do it for me. So I've got a tools folder here where I'm doing that. So first thing I want to do is actually customize. I'm going to do this in stages. That's why you see my really bad numbering scheme of how I do this. So the first thing I want to do is just customize the process template to where it calls the zip executable to do its magic. So if I open up this custom build process template here, this takes me into my Windows workflow template. So as you can see, this can get really, you know, trying to find exactly where you want to go can be slightly scary. But I knew that where I wanted to be was after everything got compiled and tests were run and that kind of stuff, I want to zip this stuff up. So once I know the compilation is successful. So the quick way I find that is I know I named my section package binaries. So let's make this a little bit bigger. Let's try that again, Mickey. There it is. So I added in the try, compile, and test and associate change sets and work items, I added a new section in here for my package binaries. So what I did is over here on my toolbar, I actually added an if statement. So I just drag and dropped this if statement over here, and I said, if the compilation is successful, and the way I know whether the compilation is successful or not is by checking the build compilation status to see if it succeeded. If it succeeded, then I want to do all this stuff. I want to add this package binaries thing. It's just a sequence. I just dragged the sequence onto here. And then I came down here where I have a bunch of Team Foundation build activities, a bunch of pre-built activities for me to do a bunch of different things. And what I dropped onto there was invoke process. So I dropped an invoke process onto there. An invoke process allows me to kick something off. So I basically specified a display name. I specified, give that just a second to catch up, I specified the file that I wanted it to execute. So in this case, I said, go to the sources directory. So go to the directory where the agent pulled all this stuff down local, okay? And then in that directory, there should be a tools directory. Now remember back in my team project, I created a tools folder. So I'm going to modify my process, my build definition to where it pulls that tools folder down to the right spot so that this is going to match. So this is what's going to tell me, go to the tools folder, execute 7-zip. Now, I also have to pass in arguments. So you have to pass in a whole bunch of arguments, one of which is T and then the type of zip file you want to make, which in this case is just a zip file. Then I have to pass in the output file. So I'm saying, in the binaries directory, create a file called output.zip. And then I want to say the information I want zipped up, which is everything in the binaries directory. So binaries directory /*. So it's basically that's going to go to the binaries directory after the compile, zip everything up, put it in a zip file. And it should ultimately get copied over to the drop folder as well. Now, here's the thing to remember, because this will come back and get you, because it came back and got me. When I finish editing this build template, I've made changes to it, right? Well, this thing's checked into TFS, or it's checked out of TFS right now. You got to check it back in. If you don't check it back in, then your changes aren't on TFS, and when build runs, it's going to use the version that's on TFS, which is the old copy. So as you're making changes to the build template, when you're ready, you need to check that back in, or else the build isn't going to pick it up. Now, what we're going to see is that if I close this, I come back over here to my build definition that I created with that build process. So this build definition is using that build process. Under workspace, I've added a second section to the workspace to where I'm pulling down now both my source code and that tools folder, and I'm storing it in that source directory /tools. So that the 7-zip is pulled down where I need it, so when I want to execute this thing, or when the build runs, it's going to be able to find it. So let's close that, and let's queue up this build. And we'll go back up here. I keep closing my build window. Hey, look, it's already completed. And if I go to the log, I can see where it ran the customization that I put in. So I can see basically it ran 7-zip, passed all this in. This is the output file. And if I go to the build outputs, so if I go to the drops and I drill down, I got an output.zip. Woohoo! And if I open that up just to prove my point, it's got the files in it. So I'm able to invoke stuff, and you got a whole bunch of build activities on the left-hand side. Now, we're not done. We're just getting started, all right? So the fact is, this worked because I got the command line right, and you know everything was smiling just perfect at me. If I had typed that command line wrong or whatever, I wouldn't have gotten an error. I wouldn't have gotten anything that told me it didn't work or why it didn't work. So now we need to modify this to where we get that information. So to do that, we would come back in. I created a new build process template off of this process template called custom process 2. And if we open that up, and again, I'm just doing this in stages, and I do another search for package binaries, and then I double-click package binaries to just pull it up on the screen, I've added some build messages. So, over here in my toolbox, under Team Foundation build activities, you have a bunch of different build messages. You can write out build errors, you can write out a message, you can write out warnings. So what I did is, under handle standard output, I just added a write build message, where I take the standard output and pass it into the build message. Same with error, but this time I write a build error, which will let the build know that something bad happened. So it's going to take the standard output, because if you run 7-zip from the command line, it gives you a bunch of stuff. Even when the zip is successful, it gives you a bunch of stuff. So I'm going to kick off a build then that using this process template to add in that little bit of extra, and let's see what happens. So let me close that. And if I go back over to here, I've created my build. Now this is using that build process template where all I've done is added in where I'm dealing with the standard out. Now the other thing I did do though, is if we go to edit build definition, and we go to the process, I've increased the verbosity. So by default, it's not going to, if I'd left this at normal, it wouldn't necessarily write out all those build messages for me unless I had set them to be a high versus normal. So by increasing the verbosity to detailed, it's going to pick up those extra build messages for me. So I'm going to right-click on this guy, and I'm going to queue it up too. And then we'll go back to our Build Explorer. You can see that it's queued up. You can see that I ran it earlier today. And we'll give this a second to run as well. And it finished. Now if I go to the log, check it out. Find it. I've still got this section where it was running the zip. But now, because it ran successfully and I captured the information from standard output, I actually get all this information as well, which says that it created the output file, it compressed it all, everything is okay. So I'm able to get the information that I need from this process that I'm trying to invoke. So what have we done so far? We're zipping it up, we're going to know if there's an error, because if it throws an error, then the build's going to fail and I'm going to get a message telling me why it failed. However, let's go one step further. There's exit codes we can check, right? So there's exit codes that come in. So maybe it gives a zero if it completes successfully. It gives a 255 if the process gets terminated. It gives a different error code if it can't zip up the files for whatever reason. So again, trying to make this provide more bang for the buck, we want to come into this thing and actually say, okay, well, let's make use of those error codes. So as I did before, I went to that build definition. I created a new build definition or build template. So in this case, template 3. And I went back to that same section to my package binaries. But this time, I've added some more options here. So the first thing I did was I added a variable. So I added a variable into Windows Workflow called exit code. So I added that variable by just coming down here to the bottom and saying create variable and entering that variable information. And I can scope that variable to where I need to be scoped to. In this case, I'm scoping it to the package binary section. And it needs to be an integer. This is going to be the exit code. This is going to be that value that it gives me back, a 0 or a 255 or a 7 or whatever it's going to be. Now, once you've created that variable, you've actually got to come back to the invoke zip and specify using that variable in the results section so that the invoke program gives you back that information. So I want it to use that exit code. Then what I did is I went to my toolbox and grabbed a switch statement. Switch statements, everyone's favorite thing to use rather than if, then, else, then, else. So what I did is I just dragged this switch statement onto here, and all I had to do for the switch statement was specify the expression. So I can create an expression here, but in this case, I just want to check out the exit code. And then I have to specify all my different cases. Obviously, I got to specify something for the default. So for the default, I actually put a write build error, which basically means that if I don't know how to handle this number, then I'm just going to output the number so that people can see it. And then I've got a case of zero where I'm just writing out a build message where I'm saying, oh, look, this particular binary archive has been created. And here's the name, output.zip. Perfect. For a case of one, I'm going to put, it's a non-fatal error, so I'm going to do a warning. So I'm not going to stop the build, but I'm going to do a warning, so I get a warning message that comes up. And then for these other cases, I'm actually going to throw errors. And again, all I did to create that is I added a new case by saying, you know, case 27, and then I drop an activity here. So I come down to the, and find the appropriate build activity in Theme Foundation, and drag the write activity and drop it over, fill it out. So I'm not going to save those changes. But now if we come back down, and you'll notice up here, by the way, check this out. In Team Explorer, it's tracking all the builds I've been kicking off, right? So I have a quick visual way in Team Explorer. I don't have to leave Team Explorer. I don't have to leave Visual Studio. But I can see, oh, here's the status on the past several builds, and I could double-click one of those to open up the build report. So let's come out here, cue this one up, see what happens. It's running, shouldn't take very long, in Mickey's perfect world, and it's completed. And if I view the log, then you can see I've got that check error code of process that we just added in there, where I'm checking the error code. Again, taking that one more step where it's going to throw a warning or it's going to throw an error if it finds a bad thing. This is the error functionality that we should always build in our code that we always save for last. You know, you should try to add that to your build process. Okay, two final steps that I want to do to make this really, really helpful. First step is I want to make this a little more customizable now. Because right now it creates output.zip. And everybody gets output.zip. And I don't know if that's really helpful or not. So I want to give people the ability to both control the name and control the type of zip file that's created through the build definition itself. So, as you're tired of hearing me say by now, I go back into source control and I create myself a new process, build process template. Like I did before, by going to build definition, clicking new, I'll open this sucker up and find my package binary section. And now you're going to notice that it's starting to look a little different. So, first thing I did was I created two new arguments. So I selected the arguments tab down here, created two new arguments, one called archive format, one called archive output. Archive format is the zip file. Do I want a zip file? Do I want a tar file? Do I want a, you know, whatever compression I want? And the other is archive output is the name. So it's the file format and the name that I want to use. Now, to make those show up on the build definition, you've got to go to metadata. And in the metadata, it's where you have to say, okay, so I clicked add, and I entered archive format as the name. And then I have to specify its display name. So its display name is going to be binary archive format. And then I have to specify category. So the category is, in the build definition, which you'll see it in a second, remember I had like that number one, which was the solution I want to build, and then I had the number three, which was advanced options. So this is going to create a new category called package binaries, where it's going to display archive format. And then I've got a description for the archive format. So I've got to come in here and specify both my archive format and my archive output. Now, this is kind of cool, though. I can make it required, But view this parameter when. So I could make it where maybe I'm creating this argument, but I don't want people to ever see it on the build definition. So I can select never. Or I can make it where they can only see it when they're editing the build definition. So they can see it on the build definition screen, but when they go to queue the build, it doesn't show up on that second tab where you can specify extra parameters. Or I could make it where it doesn't show up on the build definition, and it only it shows up on that second tab. But being me, and I like to let my users do pretty much anything they want, I'm going to make it show up everywhere. So that's why I chose the always show parameter. So I'm going to see this parameter both on the build definition tab as well as when I queue up that build. Now, once I've specified these two arguments and specified the metadata, then I have to come back into my invoke and replace using those arguments. So basically, file name is going to be over here, archive. Archive output is going to be, here's the archive format I want to use. And you'll notice that I'm now saying minus T and then replace the first parameter because I'm letting people specify the format that they want to use. So I specify my archive format. I'm saying what the output file folder should be. So when I build a build definition using that build template, I now have a package binary section down there. Because remember, I specified the category on those parameters. If I had given each one a different category, I would have two categories here. And then I can specify the type of file I want to create. In this case, I'll stick with zip. And then I can specify my output file, which, as you can see when I was testing last night, was please work. So we'll leave that because we can. And that's good. So I'm going to queue this up. So queue new build. And on the parameters tab, because I said display those parameters everywhere, I can also modify the packaging here. So on this specific queuing of the build, I can modify what's going to happen. So I'll leave that like it is, and I'll queue it up. And we'll go back to our build explorer. And we will think happy thoughts. You can actually sit here and watch it as it runs. It'll add on to the thing, onto this, and you can zoom in or zoom out. Wow, that's too small. Okay, and it ran. I can view my log. I can come down here and I can see, yep, everything looks good. And if I go back out to where I'm dropping my files, there's my folder, or the one I just ran. And there's my please work. So see? Woo, look, parameters, it's all great. So, this is great. We now have a customized build definition, okay, that is going to zip stuff up. So anytime somebody wants something zipped up, they can just use this build definition and they can specify the file name they want it and the type. So, then you have people that come to you and go, oh, I want my own custom definition. I want my own build definition to do something, but I want all that zip stuff. All right. Could you just go back in and drag and drop all that stuff on there for me and preset all that stuff for me and make that zip work? No? Yes? No? No. We're not going to rebuild the wheel. So instead, what we're going to do is take that code that we built and build our own custom Windows workflow build activity. By doing that, we're going to then be able to reuse that code and have multiple people use that code, and if we ever need to make an update to it, we make an update in one spot, everybody gets the update. So, reasons why you might want to make your custom workflow activities, like I said, you've got things you want to reuse. There's several different ways you can make custom Windows workflow activities. You can write custom code. We're actually going to use option number 3, compose your own custom activity in XAML. We're going to actually take some of the XAML that we've already built in that custom build activity that we did before and just use that to build our custom activity. So we're not going to have to write any actual code to make this happen. So let's work some magic. So come out here. So what I did is I went file, new, project. My build succeeded, thank you. And I basically said, create a new Windows Workflow Activity Library. So let me open that up. So I created a new Windows Workflow Activity Library. So by default, it has an activity object in there, and it's gonna be blank. Oh, come on, Visual Studio. Be nice, we're almost there. There it goes. So, and I renamed it to be preinvoke.7zip. This is what I did. I came out here to one of these process templates, and I found where I had the code that I cared about, the invoke, and I basically right-clicked on it and said copy. Then I went back over to my custom activity and pasted that code in. So I pasted that code in, I kept all the error checking, all that. What I had to do is define some arguments. So I had to define a file name. So this is going to be the file that I want to use for doing the compression. Okay? I had to define the format, the output file, where the source files are going to be. These are all, when somebody uses this custom object, these are things that they're going to want to use. Once I've defined those, I can then go into my invoke and specify them. So for example, for file name, I can specify use the file name that's passed in. In fact, I actually should replace that with file name there. That would be a bad coding error. For arguments, I can say use the arguments that are filled out. So these are going to be arguments, going to be parameters that are used for this object. Once I finish defining those, I just build it, right? I right-click on it and build it. That gives me a DLL. It's a DLL with Windows Workflow Activity in it. So now, you got to put it in the GAC. If you don't put it in the GAC, then what you'll find is, very frustratingly, when you try to drag and drop it onto a designer surface, it won't drag and drop. So you put it in the GAC, and then I have the capability. If we open up process template number 5. Do a search for package binaries. To, in my toolbox, have a custom activity that all I did was drag and drop onto here. I specify those same things I specified before. So like for file name, I specify this is the location of the file name. For output file path, this is where I need things outputted. But now I've, instead of having to build all that stuff every time I want to build this functionality into a new template, I can just drag and drop this one object, fill out the parameters, bam. So easy code reuse, which is what we all love. Cool. All right, so I got 2 minutes left, so bear with me. Told you it was mostly demo. So what's new in Team Foundation Server 2012 as far as build goes? You've got hosted build service. If you've not yet looked at tfspreview.com, I think it got opened up on Monday to everybody. You've got hosted build services out there where now you can actually have builds that run, that run in the cloud. Now, here's the question. When you build something in the cloud, where do the files go? Right? You can't drop them on a local share. So they've added in this new feature called being able to drop them into version control. So if you specify a hosted build service that you're going to use, as part of that, there's the definition will change slightly, and you can specify, here's where I want those things dropped in version control itself. Batch gated check-in is new. There have been some updates to the build service protocol, as well as the build report got slightly updated as well. I got to give a special thanks to Brian Randall, Ed, and Martin for helping me out with this talk. Here's my information. I'm out of time. I know there's another speaker that has to come up here after me. Give me 2 minutes to shut things down, and I will stand right over here and answer as many questions as people have. Thank you very much. Please fill out your evals.